And good afternoon, Scott Spears back with you here on this Thursday, January the 17th, 2019, 16 minutes past the hour, and away we go. We want to thank Barry Farber for being on in hour number one. It's always fun to talk current events and issues of the day with Barry Farber. And don't forget, you can catch Barry's show on the CRN Talk Network, the Barry Farber Show. Don't miss it. Now, this hour, we're going to continue our conversation into current events and issues of the day, and there certainly are a lot of them. We're so grateful every time our guest this hour drops by, and so thankful that she's able to come back, because last Wednesday, she was on this program, and we had a power outage. The lights and everything else went out right in the middle of our interview, well, actually about 10 minutes in. But the good news is the government is still shut down, and not a lot has changed since that interview, except now it is the longest government shutdown in federal history, and there were a few new other tidbits to talk about, so we're always happy when Eleanor Clift comes back to these microphones. You can read her columns on the Daily Beast and catch her on the McLaughlin Group. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing well. It's we're having a kind of a frigid winter here in Washington, and another snow watch coming this weekend, but nothing like what you have in Ohio, so I shouldn't complain.
We're waiting to see what this weekend brings. We're anywhere from 8 to 20 inches, and I think we'll know more tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah. So hopefully it's nothing too dangerous, but the government remains shut down. Now, an interesting part of this government shutdown happened yesterday when people who use the EBT food cards got paid for February yesterday. But they won't get paid again in February, is my understanding.
Okay, so was that just a glitch, or is that, I think, you know, the government has been trying to respond to certain particular areas of need. I mean, like the IRS has called back, I think it's a 4,700 or is it 47,000 workers to be processing tax refunds, but they're coming back and they're not getting paid. And of course, the TSA people are, and air controllers and all of those folks who are in very critical positions, they're working without paychecks. And a higher number of TSA agents apparently are calling in sick because, you know, they've got other issues to deal with, and to come to work without getting a paycheck seems a little bit too much to ask.
Well, this is the question, Eleanor, in regard to the government shutdown. Yes, last Friday was a big day because it became the longest shutdown in government history, and yes, that was the first time people actually did not get a paycheck. But what happens the 1st of February when it's a whole month people have not gotten a paycheck, and people's EBT cards do not reload in February? And I assume some of these people, if the government shutdown has not lifted, who work for the TSA and the FDA and the IRS, do not come back to work and find other work. If it continues that long till the 1st of February, can people make their mortgage payments? Can they pay their bills? What happens?
First of all, I think the president is really out of touch on this one. I think he has said, well, people adjust. They always do. And, you know, various sites have suggested, you know, go to your mortgage company and explain the situation. First of all, I don't think a lot of mortgage companies are going to give passes. And second, it would open the door to potential fraud. A lot of people could claim they've been furloughed when they haven't really, and I don't think anybody has the capacity to be checking up on everybody. But that's why Speaker Pelosi was attempting to put a little more pressure on the president by saying that he's not invited to the House to deliver the State of the Union until the government is opened. The State of the Union originally started out, it was a written address to the country, and I think it was Woodrow Wilson who was the first one to deliver it in the House chamber. But the president is there at the invitation of the speaker, and she is withdrawing that invitation until after the government opens, or she said he could deliver it from somewhere else, like the Oval Office, or he could send it in writing. And that seems to have discombobulated the White House. They weren't expecting that. And Stephen Miller, who's the president's kind of top policy aide and speechwriter, is apparently, you know, writing a speech that was outlining the president's case for border security and for closing the government and all that. And they were looking forward to this prime time moment. Apparently, in his inaugural address last year, State of the Union address last year, there were 45 million people watched. So it's a big audience, and the president doesn't want to forego it. But there's still no end in sight to the government shutdown. I've heard some interesting theories. It's been postulated that the shutdown and ordering people to work without paying them is a violation of the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment is the amendment that that banned slavery and involuntary servitude. You could make the case that asking people to show up for work and not giving them a paycheck is an example of involuntary servitude. I would think there are going to be lawsuits about this shutdown, and that might be one of the principles that they rest on, that it's unconstitutional. And then I wrote a piece for the Daily Beast, which I hope they'll post tomorrow or over the weekend, about the president calling a state of emergency being the best, worst option, because it would open the government. It would allow him a path to get the money for a wall that will likely never be built, and it would be challenged in the courts, and almost certainly, I think, the grounds for his calling a state of emergency would be rejected. So I think that's still on the table, and the New York Times today has a front-page piece about how frustrated the president is that the Democrats haven't come around. And the last sentence of that story, which of course is on an inside page, says that the option to declare a state of emergency is still on the table.
You know, Eleanor, it's interesting, talking to Barry Farber, we wrapped up our conversation last hour by talking about that exact same thing. At this point, I think if the president declared a state of emergency, it would open up the government, people would get their money, people would get what they need, people would go back to work. The president would be able to say, I didn't cave in on this, and there is the possibility that he could get a wall. The Democrats could say, we didn't cave in, and there is the possibility that the wall would not be built. I think that would have a 90% approval in this country right now for him to do that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the idea of a wall, as this president has conjured up, it's a towering concrete barrier that goes from sea to shining sea, when in fact this is a border of, I think it's almost 2,000 miles, and there are sections where there already is a wall, and there are sections where a wall makes sense, and there are other sections where there are other barriers, and there are some sections where you're dealing with eminent domain and people's rights to their private property, and you're dealing with environmental questions, so that whatever is appropriated, I think the Washington Post said even if 10,000 contractors or workers, 10,000 workers were immediately deployed, it would take 10 years to build any kind of, you know, substantial wall. So it's become, I guess, a metaphor, a symbol, it's a, you know, political football, use whatever term you want, and the president is not going to back off unless it looks like he has won, because he sees that as his roadmap to reelection. He's convinced that if he gives in on this, he can't win re-election because his base will desert him.
Well, Barry Farber last hour, who has a pretty big radio audience, he said that point blank. He said the president will lose his base. And I think these conservative radio talk show hosts believe that.
Well, but they're the ones that put the pressure on the president. You know, he was the Senate passed, I think, you know, legislation that the president had signed off on, that included a lower number for border security, and it was all set to go. The Senate passed the House, passed the Senate, and the president sort of blew it up because he heard from, I guess, Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham and that crowd. I don't know if the base really takes the wall that seriously either. I don't know that there's any real polling on that, but I think it's developed into this cause celeb. I mean, I think initially they probably went along with the joke, too, you know, wall, no wall. It was a campaign promise. And now it's become the end-all, be-all, because the conservative media has taken it up as a cudgel, and the president is following their lead, and they proclaim to speak for the Trump base. Maybe they're right, but you know, anyone who is going to be open to the logistics of a wall ought to be able to understand that, you know, this is not something that you want to build across that area, and there are other ways to protect the border, and that 75% of the people who overstay their visas in this country come in by air, and they don't come in, they're not sneaking across the border, and drugs are coming in other ways. It's not, you know, you can't build a wall to protect this country against the scourges that the president is outlining. If you want protection, there are other ways to do it, but a wall doesn't really make sense financially or otherwise.
You know, Eleanor, what's interesting to me is you have the president who, you know, since the campaign has said he wanted this wall. You have the Democrats who clearly do not want this wall and have passed a budget without the wall in it. And then you have the Senate. Now, the Senate will not put legislation, Mitch McConnell will not put legislation on the floor of a Republican Senate. A matter of fact, a more Republican Senate than it was before the last election. What is the fear there, that they would pass it to open back up the government?
Yes, they would pass it, and then he'd face the wrath of the president. And there are 22 Republicans who are up for re-election in 2020, including Mitch McConnell. And at this moment, they're more afraid of a challenge from the right than they are of a Democratic opposition. And so they don't want to incur Trump's wrath. And I suppose the president could veto the legislation. I don't know if there'd be enough votes to override. That would take a two-thirds majority in each house. Not sure that exists. And so I think McConnell looks at it as a kind of a fiasco that he wants to stay away from. And so his strategy has been to just lie low and to pretend it's entirely up to the president and the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate to come to a deal. Then he'll facilitate it, but he's not going to put anything on the floor that will not get Trump's signature. That's his stated objective. And a lot of people have said, well, that's not the role of the Senate. You shouldn't just pass legislation that you know is going to get signed. But that's his position as of now. And again, as I said, he's one of those who's up for re-election in 2020. And his when he ran the last time, he had Republican opposition from Matt Bevin, who is to his right and who is currently the governor of Kentucky. So I don't know if there's an identifiable opponent that he already has, but he's clearly looking at his own re-election. And with just about every one of these people,
the last poll,
I was going to say every one of these guys, but there are women up there too.
There are.
It's their own survival that comes first, not the country's.
It's interesting to me because the last poll that I saw, give or take, with a margin of error, right now 60% are blaming Trump, 30% are blaming the Democrats, and 10% are blaming both. Now, that's a fairly even poll. So there's a lot of blame going around in general. Why, in that meeting, when President Trump came in, are you going to give me my wall? Nancy Pelosi says no. He leaves. Is there any compromise they can make shy of this emergency clause that the president could do, I guess, if he wanted to?
The most likely thing would be a deal where Trump gets his wall and the Democrats get protection for the Dreamers. And the problem is that that was presented to him last winter, and it was okay in both houses, and everybody was on board. And then the right-wing media screamed amnesty. They were giving amnesty to the Dreamers, and the president stopped it. So that's been on the table. So then just this week, beginning on Monday, Lindsey Graham in the Senate was meeting with a group of bipartisan senators, and they were trying to work out a similar thing, you know, wall money, protection for the Dreamers. And Trump just called him out and said, you know, I won't do it. And so he blocked that effort. So I don't know where the deal is. You know, the Democrats, I think they're on firm ground that you don't give in to a bully who doesn't have the votes to get what he wants in the Congress, so he shuts down the government. You can't really set that precedent. If you do, he can do it over, you know, when you have to raise the debt ceiling, he could do it over the next budget. It becomes kind of routine partisan warfare. So they feel they've got to hold their ground. The president so far is kind of ignoring the downside of what he's doing and still believes that whatever he does that holds his base has got to be his top priority.
You know, I certainly understand the right-wing media narrative that is out there, that that's what changed President Trump's mind. But what I don't understand is, I guess I would understand that more if this was Trump's first budget. But it's his third. And right. In 2017 and 2018, when he had a Republican Congress, which would have possibly, they certainly would have been more likely to pass this than Nancy Pelosi's Congress is, why was it never put in then?
Because Republicans didn't want it. He didn't have support from the Republicans. Now, he didn't make it the end-all, be-all that he's done this time around. Now, maybe if he had done that with the Republicans, they would have given in, and it would have been easier for them to give in than for the Democrats. He couldn't get it out of a Republican Congress. He tried, not as vigorously as he's trying now, but Republicans don't really want this either, or they didn't. Maybe now that it's become so partisan with the Democrats, you probably have more Republicans who support it.
Is there any fear? Because I've wondered this. President Trump, we know who he is now. We've seen him for 3 years, 4 years on the national political arena. So we know how he acts. But Nancy Pelosi has done some things in the last couple weeks. After the meeting last week when she gave her press conference, she slipped the line in there about people's daddies aren't going to come bail them out, people who aren't getting paychecks, now rescinding the order for the State of the Union. Is there a fear that public opinion could start to turn against her? I don't think she's very popular as a person across the country.
Well, I can't speak for across the country, but I think in Washington, Democrats in particular are really proud of the way she's standing her ground. And the New York Times has a front page story today, and one of the bylines is Maggie Haberman, who has covered Trump for years and covered him in New York before he became president. And everybody kind of assumes that she has a pipeline into his thinking. And it basically says that he has backed off from insulting her directly because, A, he regards her as the person who's going to protect him from impeachment, because she doesn't really want the Democratic House to make that a priority, at least initially. And he also respects her skills. So I think she's doing very well. I mean, there's always the possibility that the country could just get so sick of this that it becomes more, you know, pox on both your houses, and that the blame would fall equally on Republicans and Democrats. But right now, I think the dominant faction in the country does point to Trump, who, of course, very proudly said that he wore the mantle and that he was proud to call this the Trump shutdown.
It's an interesting time, to be sure. How long do you think this shutdown's going to go, if you had to give a guess?
I'm thinking that the 29th which is the end of this month, which was the scheduled date for the State of the Union, that there will be a renewed effort to have it end by then so that the president can go ahead with his scheduled speech and claim victory, however it ends. I mean, that's the most logical. And today's only, what, the 17th? So that would be still another 27, more than 10 days away. So, you know, if they're going to come to a resolution, they certainly ought to be able to do it within that time. The president has said, though, it could go on for years. And I spoke to a government and politics professor at George Washington University's Graduate School of Management. His name is Matthew Dalek. And he kind of outlined how, you know, the president really, he wants the issue. I think he wants the issue more than he wants the wall. And he could envision him, you know, if the state of emergency does go ahead, and if the president tries to get money for the wall and it's blocked by the courts, he can then go into 2020 and say, you know, I did everything I could. I presided over the longest shutdown in government history, and then the Democrats and the courts prevented me. If you want the wall, you know, reelect me and vote for Republicans in 2020. That, you know, border security in 2020, it's a pretty good campaign slogan. So that argues for this kind of last-ditch effort of the state of emergency and how that would at least open the government. And then the president could still probably have an issue because it'll get tied up in the courts, and it's probably unlikely that he would get money from the Pentagon or money out of disaster funds to build the wall.
Certainly the government has been somewhat divided, I think, since maybe the midway through the presidency of George W. Bush to a high standard. Is this the most divided that this issue, Democrat-Republican, one issue, has shut us down for longer than we've ever been shut down before?
Yeah, I think by that measurement, I think the previous record for shutdown was 1995 with Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, and that was over, I think, the safety net, Social Security, Medicare funding, if I remember correctly. And the president then, Clinton, benefited from it because Newt Gingrich went on Air Force One. It was a long plane ride. They went to somebody's funeral overseas, I think it was. And Gingrich imagined that he would be negotiating about ending the shutdown on the long plane ride home. Instead, he complained that Clinton was in the front of the cabin just playing hearts with aides, and that he, Newt Gingrich, had to descend from the plane from the back door. He found that humiliating. And he complained about that as breakfast with reporters, and the New York Post ran, or I think it was the New York Daily News, ran a front page photo of Gingrich in diapers calling him, you know, crybaby Newt, and public opinion just shifted like that. So Clinton came out the big winner, and the Republicans had to yield. I think it was safety net questions. But the fact that I can't remember the specific issue now, I mean, I'll never forget that this shutdown was around the wall. It's very easy to remember. But, yeah, by the number of days that their shutdown has been in effect, you know, Trump has created for himself and for the country, you know, an economic disaster. I mean, it is, even the White House has upped their assessment of how much this is costing the economy every week.
You know, it is interesting because there are some perils here between the Clinton and the Trump presidency. There was a long shutdown. There was a change from Democrat to Republican during Clinton's presidency. This way, we've went from Republican to Democrat under Trump. It has caused a shutdown, a rather long shutdown, which the Clinton Gingrich shutdown was a rather long shutdown, the longest until this one. But in the end, Clinton won re-election by a large margin. He was impeached. There's talk of that with President Trump, and Clinton did not get convicted. He left office with very high approval ratings. Could the same happen with President Trump?
First of all, I would say the alleged crimes are totally different. And I think James Carville has said it's like the difference between driving 10 miles over in a speed limit in a 10 miles over the speed limit in a zone, and driving 50 miles over the speed limit drunk in a school zone. So, I mean, the breadth of what President Trump can potentially be accused of is much broader than Clinton, which was basically lying over a private sexual encounter. And when the Republican House voted to impeach Clinton on a party line, I guess it was December of 95? I forget now. I forget the date. But Clinton's approval rating went up to 74%. And it was actually, Clinton was impeached in his second term. So it would have been 90.
I think it was 98.
Eight.
Yeah.
98. He was impeached in his second term. Okay. And his approval rating during that process, which was seen as very partisan, his approval rating went up to 74%. And Ken Starr, who was the special prosecutor at the time, the special counsel, his approval rating was 13%. So I think we're looking at a different president. President Trump has never broken 50%. He's now in the high 30s, early 40s. Robert Mueller, who's the special counsel, is got majority approval and certainly a very high approval among Democrats, and I think he does break 50% even among Republicans. So I think it's just such a different circumstance here. And as Clinton wasn't facing re-election. He'd been re-elected. He lost a lot of time in his second term when he could have gotten some big projects done because of that, but he didn't lose re-election. He didn't lose a second term. Trump is potentially, looking at a re-election that could be problematical.
Speaking of the Mueller investigation, last night Rudy Giuliani appeared on CNN on the Chris Cuomo show, a live interview. And at one point when Cuomo was asking him about Manafort giving the polling data to people in the Russian government, Rudy Giuliani said, I never said there was no collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia.
Right.
What do you think he was talking about?
He's claiming now the president didn't collude. But he's basically saying, no big deal. That if you're running a campaign, you're going to potentially be dealing with foreign powers. So, that it would not be a crime. So I guess you can argue that collusion is not a crime until you get into intent. And if the intent is to help a foreign power influence an American election in favor of somebody you're working for, which is potentially what happened here, I think that's a problem. So, and we got the first glimpse of that in learning that Paul Manafort had shared Trump polling data with a Russian contact who's very close to President Putin. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's not a smoking gun until you have President Trump involved in the middle of it. But, I mean, I think that's pretty clear evidence that something went on here. And we do know Russia interfered in the election. And the question is, did they get help from the Trump campaign in that interference?
Well, that's a big question that I think people have this morning after that quote by Rudy Giuliani last night. We don't know if the president knew that that was going on or not, but if the campaign did collude with Russia, isn't that still a problem?
I think it's a political problem. I don't know. Again, you have to get into intent. I don't know that it's a criminal problem. I mean, I leave that up to the lawyers.
In the future, when people run campaigns, because we will get into a presidential election very, very soon, as long as the person running doesn't know, is it okay to do things like this?
There's a principle called deniability. And when President Reagan was in office and there was this trading of arms for hostages, and I think the CIA, then CIA Chief Bill Casey, was aware of it. You had Oliver North and so forth. President Reagan said he didn't know anything about it. And that's the principle of deniability. They knew that he wanted to help the Contras, but they knew that what they were doing was illegal, and so they kept him, another famous Washington phrase, out of the loop. So if the people around Trump were smart enough, they would have kept President Trump away from any of this, even though they probably felt that they would have had his blessing if he had known. But I think that whole campaign was so haphazard, principally because they didn't really think they were going to win. And I think everybody was there just trying to cash in on their way to Election Day, assuming that it would all be over and he wouldn't win. And so they put themselves in a lot of compromising positions, you know, thinking they would never be held accountable because they weren't going to Washington and he wouldn't be president. And they were just making money.
Well, that's
on the way there.
That's an interesting question. If President Trump had not won, would Paul Manafort be in prison right now? Would Michael Cohen be facing prison time? Would any of these people have ever gotten into any trouble?
Probably not, which is why billionaires with spotty records of how they made their money generally don't run for president, or if they do run for president, they don't share their income tax returns, or they're not very transparent about their finances, and that's certainly true of Trump. Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, if Trump had lost, everybody would have written it up to, a bad joke. He was good copy while he lasted, glad he didn't win. And we now have the establishment candidate, and we're in safe hands. And I don't think anybody would have been trying to build a case against Paul Manafort or any of the other people on the campaign trail. And I think Ivanka and Jared would be free, and Don Jr. would be free. They're all facing significant legal issues, and they're all lawyered up to the hilt because they know potentially what could be ahead. I don't think anybody would have been, you know, looking into the Trump Foundation. Now, the Trump University, that whole scam had been exposed during the campaign, so that would have come to a head. But all the other things he was involved in, I think, you know, the media would have moved on.
You know, it's interesting. We had a big story last week in which we all found out that counterintelligence, the FBI, had opened up a inquiry about the president wittingly or unwittingly being a Russian spy. Now, at the time, I think we all said, boy, that's different. That's never happened before. But in the long run, now that that story's been out there a few days, it seems like that story, in a way, is working for the president because it feeds into they were out to get me. We don't have an end to that story. Nobody has said he was a Russian spy wittingly or unwittingly. Giuliani said last night that if they had found evidence of that, they couldn't have passed it off to Robert Mueller. How do you see that story a week later?
Well, Robert Mueller is quiet. He only speaks through his court filings, and he reveals as little as possible. We don't know what he did with that investigation, which I think, according to the Times's, or the Times's reporting, that was turned over to Mueller. So his report will spell that out. You know, the other side is just a lot of noise, you know, saying, you know, it's the deep state and it's a plot against the president and this is an FBI going rogue. And people who want to believe that are going to believe that. But at some point, the facts about this are going to come out. And I do think that the Mueller report will be significant in explaining in a pretty straightforward manner exactly what he found and what he didn't find. Maybe it'll be a political earthquake, maybe it won't, but I do think there's a thoroughness about Mueller as a prosecutor and an investigator that the country should have some confidence in.
If we watch any of the news channels, I think we all get the impression, as of late, that there is a lot of comparison to Nixon, and there is a lot of comparison to Clinton. Now, what I keep thinking when they're making these comparisons is that Nixon's crime was covering up a break-in at the Watergate Hotel. Clinton's crime, as you said, was lying under oath, and even what they were investigating him for, land deals, you know, that all was not prescient. Nixon's wasn't prescient. He won the election with 48 states, I think, over McGovern. But could there be a turn on Mueller? Because if people believe the Mueller report when it comes out, and I'm sure there are people who won't, if there is something in there, like President Trump did know about collusion with Russia, that he was wittingly or unwittingly working as a Russian spy, he's been president. And we had to wait for the end of the report to even know about that. Could there be a little backlash over that,
I mean, that Mueller should have told us what he had before he fully investigated it? No,
well,
I don't think so. The House will, I mean, depending on what is in his report, I assume the House will have some hearings, and some of the people who are now, you know, names in the news will be appearing. In fact, you have Michael Cohen in early February who's going to be appearing. And I think that television is going to attract some attention, and the story will begin to take on, you know, some dimensions and not just a bunch of names. So I don't see anybody, you know, turning on Mueller for not, as far as these federal investigations go, he's quite timely. You know, the Iran-Contra investigation under Reagan and then Bush, I think, went on for 7 years. The Whitewater, which then morphed into Monica Lewinsky, went on for, you know, much of, I guess it started in Clinton's first term and went into his second term. So, you know, I think, you know, it behooves us all to let Mueller finish his work and produce it. And that was the centerpiece of the hearings this week for the new Attorney General William Barr, who's likely to be confirmed since there are 53 Republicans and they only need 50. And he's an establishment figure, somewhat reassuring, but he certainly danced around whether he would ever allow whatever Mueller produces to become public. He basically gave assurances that he would protect Mueller and allow Mueller to finish his work, but he was quite cagey on whether he would ever allow that report to become public.
Well, the thing that I got out of the story by the New York Times last week about the investigation into President Trump being wittingly or unwittingly an agent of the Russian government, I think the problem becomes is that if Mueller has any evidence that that is true, that decisions are being made that are costing people their lives, like the pullout in Syria, are they being made because the president is compromised? I think that hopefully somebody in the Congress or the Senate would be aware of this so they could stop this, cut this off.
Well, I do think the way the president announced the pullout from Syria was very sudden and did raise questions, but, you know, other people have talked about coming out of Syria, I think, you know, too. To ask if Mueller had found direct connection, you know, Putin gets on the phone, get out of Syria, and then people are killed. It's much more nuanced foreign policy. The president has basically emboldened Saudi Arabia and Iran and Russia and various powers in the Middle East, and they've filled a vacuum that he has left. So it's a bigger question than that, but the fact that he was apparently hell bent on pulling out of NATO, you know, that would be Putin's top aim, to have the Americans pull out of NATO, which would fracture the U.S. European alliance. Now that's another one of Putin's priorities. So, yeah, I think if let's see what we find out about what Putin may or may not have on Trump and what Trump thinks Putin may or may not have on him. I mean, there does seem to be some kind of connection there that is not wholesome.
Well, the interesting thing, and it's my understanding that this is unprecedented, that the meetings that President Trump has had with Vladimir Putin, that nobody else has seen the notes, nobody else was in these meetings except one interpreter, and now Adam Schiff, last night I saw on Anderson Cooper, talking about possibly subpoenaing her, or maybe not even having to do that, to learn what she knows. Now, I would think the reason for having her do that is that something was talked about directly.
This is a female translator?
Yeah. So I guess if everything is more nuanced and it's not done explicitly between Putin and Trump in a phone call or a meeting, what is the point of learning things from this translator? Why did President Trump tear those notes up?
Well, the official White House explanation is that He was trying to guard against leaks, and he doesn't trust anybody in his own inner circle. But they couldn't come up with any other examples with any other world leaders where he excluded everyone from his side, and tore up notes. So that didn't really hold water too much. But what it reminds me of is during the Clinton impeachment effort. Ken Starr subpoenaed members of the Secret Service as to what they had seen. And the Secret Service really resisted because they thought that would compromise the role that they play if the people who were guarded have to worry about whatever the agents see potentially being made public. They lost that, and the Secret Service agents did testify. I don't know what they said. It's probably that's out there somewhere. But a translator is, again, another one of these sort of neutral people that shouldn't be pulled into this kind of thing. But it seems to me if there was a precedent they could pull in the Secret Service, they could certainly pull in a translator. And I would imagine that maybe a House committee would request this person to appear, or could issue a subpoena.
Could President Trump, if this wall does not get built, whether he has to cave in or he has to use the emergency clause and it goes to lawyers and it never happens, could he then use the Democrats as kind of a battering ram that they're obstructing me, they're stopping me from doing what is good for you?
Absolutely. That's the political professor, politics of government professor, who I quote in my Daily Beast piece, which I hope will be posted tomorrow over the weekend, where he says that Trump gets to have the issue and goes into 2020 saying, you want to protect our southern border? You know, vote for me and reelect Republicans. Democrats and the courts are preventing your security. I mean, it's a ready-made issue for him.
A lot of people on the Democratic side are starting committees, going to places where early primaries are held. Do you see anybody out there so far on the Democratic side that's of interest, could be the next candidate for president on the Democratic side?
I think there are a lot of interesting people already. I think Kamala Harris, and she's tiptoed up to the announcement. She hasn't quite announced, but she is a strong contender, former attorney general in California. Sherrod Brown, Ohio, who's won big in Ohio, and he's embarked on a working people's tour. Now, you're familiar with him because that's Ohio, and he's going to several early primary states to make the case that when you talk about working people, you're talking about black and white. This is not just zeroing on the Trump base. This is everybody. I think he's an interesting figure. And then Amy Klobuchar, who looks like she's going to get in, just won a big reelection in Minnesota, another kind of more centrist figure. And Elizabeth Warren was first out, and she's got her economic message, which is very powerful. And you know, my feeling is this is like chorus line. You've got lots of people competing. They're not just competing for the number one slot. They're competing for VEEP. They're competing for cabinet spots. Elizabeth Warren could be the next Treasury Secretary. Let them all get out there and let's hear their ideas. And I hope it can be conducted in a way that, you know, is fairly civil and respectful. I think these are all, for the most part, people who know each other and like each other. So I think we could be looking at a really fascinating evolution here to finally reach who will be the nominee. I like the fact that Governor Inslee of Washington State is getting in on a climate change is his major issue. So that issue certainly needs attention. And, of course, Beto O'Rourke, front page piece in today's Washington Post, pointing out that he's opposed to the wall, but his immigration policy or stands or positions are pretty fuzzy. So he's going to now be pressed for his specific ideas and not just hope and change. So I think everybody's going to get their turn in the barrel a little bit, and we'll see who survives.
Final question, Eleanor. Our Governor John Kasich recently departed that position this week and took a job with CNN the next day. What do you think he's doing?
Well, he's keeping his name out there, and he's doing what Mitt Romney said. He's going to see how things shake out. And I suppose a primary one in 2020 is potentially possible. Right now, the Republican support for Trump among self-identified Republicans who vote in Republican primaries is like 85%. So it would be kind of a suicide mission to run in a primary. But that, you know, that could change. I also noticed that Claire McCaskill, former Missouri senator, she just got defeated. She signed on with MSNBC as an analyst, so I don't think she's running again. But you know, these people who have been involved in the political fray can bring an added dimension to the commentary, and the cables are signing them up.
They certainly are. Check for Eleanor's column coming up in the next few days on thedailybeast.com. Eleanor, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Same here. Thanks, Scott.
Bye-bye.
And that's all the time we have today. Hope you stay tuned for more programming and check back with us tomorrow. Over the Back Fence with Pastor Steve Whitaker at 10 a.m., Talk of the Town with Marge Hazelett at 11, Exchange Club at 12, and Charlie Evers 1 to 3. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
You have the answer. Call 740-383-9944, and the gift card to Kroger is yours. And just when you thought there couldn't be any more, WGH Studios in the Marion Center Mall across